Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 13th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening.
I want $10 million for charity.
We've already raised a lot of money for the vets.
American Cancer Society, AIDS Research.
I have raised a tremendous amount of money for the vets, almost $6 million.
I'm giving them away. I'm giving the profits of my book, I'm giving them away to a lot of different, including the vets.
I don't talk about it. I don't like to talk about it. And I paid off a mortgage. Big deal, right?
It's good to do things like that for people. It's nice. It's nice. Makes you feel good.
They paid me a lot of money, and they were very generous. And all of that money goes to charity.
Well, Donald Trump has relished in press coverage of the Clinton Foundation, who gives and how it operates. Now Donald Trump's history of charitable giving is getting more attention under the guise of his Trump Foundation, created in 1987. Now, if you don't follow David Fahrenthold of The Washington Post on Twitter, you should. Fahrenthold has been spending months digging down into years of transactions and claims about Donald Trump's philanthropy, and he's been tweeting about it all the way through while researching his stories. In his latest piece, Fahrenthold finds that Donald Trump hasn't actually given any of his own money to the foundation bearing his name since 2008. Instead, the foundation uses other people's money, while he often takes personal credit for those gifts. And in other cases, direct evidence that Donald Trump uses charitable money for illegal campaign contributions or personal purchases. David Fahrenthold joins me now from Washington, D.C. Hi, David.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It's great to have you here. Now, you've been following Donald Trump's charitable activities for months now. I described some of the top lines. What have you found out?
So there's two things to look at here. And first, we'll talk about the Donald Trump Foundation. That's the one that you can sort of track through tax filings. That's the giving that Trump has talked about a lot. That's the only part of his public – of his giving that actually I can find any evidence of in public. And that's a really interesting foundation. I talked to tax experts who say it's not like anyone they've ever seen in that it has Donald Trump's name on it. People assume that if a rich man starts a foundation, it's the money in the foundation comes from him. But as you said, he hasn't actually given any money to it since 2008. Instead, he's been giving away other people's money. He's been gathering other people's money and giving it away with his own name on the check under the impression that it's his money. So he's basically found a way to have his philanthropy for free.
And this isn't normal. As you say, charitable foundations, usually the implication, the strong implication is the rich person is giving their own money. So when he has used this foundation for this purpose, there are other cases that suggest that he's even made money on some of his appearance of charity.
That's right. Trump, one of his big businesses is renting out the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach that he owns for charitable events. That's a lot of what people do in Palm Beach, and it costs a lot of money to rent out Mar-a-Lago. We wrote about one group in our story on Sunday. Just one night, renting out the Mar-a-Lago for one night cost them $267,000. So Trump makes a lot of money off these charities, and often the donations that he gives to them with other people's money from his Trump Foundation, it helps him stay in the good graces of those charities. It helps him appear generous if he goes to those charities' events and says, oh, I'll give $100,000, and it doesn't actually cost him anything. So he keeps that relationship with the charity, and then he gets all the money they give him.
So what about all of the charities that Donald Trump has said or bragged or boasted that he's given to, saying he sent money to various vets organizations? What have you found out there?
Well, look back at going back to January. January, Trump had this big fundraiser in Iowa where he talked about, you know, he skipped the Fox News debate. He held this big fundraiser and he said he raised $6 million for the veterans. That's sort of when I started digging into this. And that turned out to be mostly other people's money that came into the Trump Foundation and then was given out. Often the charities would get a letter from the Donald J. Trump Foundation signed by Donald J. Trump and then a check with somebody else's name on it, or a check from the Trump Foundation, which was originally somebody else's money. The part of that giving that Trump said would actually come out of his own pocket to the veterans was $1 million. He said on stage, and I gave $1 million, past tense, in January. It turned out months later, we were trying to figure out, did Trump really give that money? His campaign actually told us, yes, he's given the money secretly. We don't want to tell anybody where it went. It was secret. Well, I went looking for it, trying to find the veterans groups that had gotten $1 million. And it turned out that was a lie. Donald Trump hadn't actually given the money out. And it was only after we sort of exposed that, that he really did give the money out sort of in the middle of the night in one fell swoop to a group that he already knew and had given him an award. So that sort of was the genesis of all my looking at Trump's charity, was this thing that he did in Iowa, drew so much attention to himself by raising money for the veterans, then he failed to follow through until he was put under some pretty extreme pressure.
So Donald Trump's campaign spokesman Hope Hicks has responded saying your story is inaccurate. Has she given any evidence as to why it's inaccurate or taken issue with any of the specifics in anything that you've written?
Not at all. In fact, we asked them for comment for that story, and they did not comment at all. And then after the fact said it was inaccurate, but did not point out any inaccuracies.
You can read David Fahrenthold's reporting throughout The Washington Post as he continues to dig into the charitable giving or lack thereof of Donald Trump and his foundation. And I want to reiterate, if you're not following him on Twitter, you're missing something, because this has been an ongoing sort of anthology of facts gained and facts missed as David Fahrenthold continues to dig into the complex and sometimes murky world of charitable giving by Donald Trump. David Fahrenthold, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our convention occurs at a moment of crisis.
America is stronger together.
We are going to build a great border wall.
We will not build a wall.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo.
A country where all our children can dream, and those dreams are within reach.
There can be no prosperity without law and order.
For all those who vote for me and for those who don't. For all Americans together.
Well, this presidential campaign is about to see something the country has never seen before. The head-to-head, face-to-face debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. 90 minutes, 2 minutes per question. It's the same format since 1960. The famous debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, the one that gave politics its modern truism about the importance of the televised image, right? But a lot has changed in politics and in media since then. And Donald Trump may have a sense that he's in for a confrontation that will be hard to win in the traditional way. Here he was on CNBC yesterday.
I think maybe we should have no moderator. Let Hillary and I sit there and just debate, because I think the system is being rigged, so it's going to be a very unfair debate.
Now, Donald Trump seems to want to throw away the old idea of the political boxing match. This is the octagon, Hillary Clinton in debate terms, the traditional heavyweight, and Trump, a WWE wrestler primed to insult and belittle his opponent. Hey, it's worked for him so far. Why change? James Fallows is here. He's written about the debates since 2000. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. His latest piece, Who'll Win, is the October issue of The Atlantic at theatlantic.com. James, welcome back to the show.
Todd, thanks very much.
And it's great to have you. All presidential debates are important and have memorable moments, but you've painted a picture of sort of the ultimate political clash here.
I think this one will be different from any that we've had, and not just because it's the first one involving a woman as a candidate for president. That over the years, as you know, these debates are important because it's the only chance to see the two candidates head-to-head and see how they respond in real time to surprises. And usually the things we remember are not the logical words that a person says, but the physical implications. Does someone flinch, as Dan Quayle did when Lloyd Benson said, "You're no Jack Kennedy," or as Jimmy Carter did when Ronald Reagan said, there you go again. In the case of Trump and Clinton, there's never been as extreme in all fronts a contrast as this one, certainly in gender, in experience, in logical style, in rhetorical style, in background, in preparation. So anybody who's not watching this thing on September 26th is making a mistake.
No question about it. Now, you've spent a lot of time talking to experts in emotional telegraphing, television performance, political manipulation, I'll call it, about the style of these two candidates. And right now I'm most interested in Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton is a traditional debater. What have you learned about what he does that's so effective?
I guess what I found myself spending a lot of time, for example, with Jane Goodall, the primatologist and the expert in
we're talking
in the
about chimps later.
Chimps. Yes. And she was saying that the way she understands Donald Trump and his dominance moves on the stage, she said actually, you know, his performance through the Republican primary debate should be understood as essentially a dominance exercise rather than any kind of logical exchange, was by looking at some of the chimps she had known in her work in Africa and the way some of them would make themselves larger and make noise to frighten and intimidate the others. And a lot of Donald Trump's primary performances could be seen as sort of intimidating his rivals. And a related point is that among the reasons to watch this thing, too, is it'll be the first time in Donald Trump's now 70 years of existence on the earth that he has ever done a head-to-head debate. That all the ones he did so far within the Republican primaries were against large groups of people, and he could sit there and wait for his moment to say low energy Jeb or build a wall or little Marco or something like that. Whereas in this case, there's going to be minutes to fill about what you're going to do on fiscal policy and how you think about NATO and all the rest. So how he's able to respond to that and the way in which his act that was so effective in the primaries, how it converts to this kind of head-to-head debate, that also will be fascinating.
Now, Hillary Clinton is an experienced debater. Unlike Trump, she's been in many, many head-to-head debates with Barack Obama, with Rick Lazio, running for Senate, running for president. Still, she struggles mightily with what we in the press have a shorthand for, trust and likability. Things that can really come through in a debate format.
That is true. And I guess there are two meta points about these debates that all of my high school and college debate teachers would tut at me if I were saying them, but they are the case. Number one, they're never about logic. They are about personality and bearing and who seems like what on that stage and which of them seems more comfortable with himself or herself and therefore comfortable in the eyes of the electorate. The other is the impressions from the debates almost always have to do with sight rather than sound. I mentioned in my article that you really should watch the debates with the sound turned off.
Yes.
If you want to have an idea of who's going to be seen as winning and losing. You won't inform yourself that much, but you'll know who's going to be seen as winning and losing. And given all of that, it actually is the case that Hillary Clinton has done better than you would think in debates than in some other kinds of dealings with the public, because her relative toughness comes across. There's only one or two missteps in her long career in debating she's seen as having made, and you know she's going to prepare for these things, probably to try to match her performance with the Benghazi Commission of Trey Gowdy and all.
Well, you're not going to watch the entire debate with the sound off because you just can't resist the temptation to listen, but do give it a try because subtext is so very important. That's according to James Fallows. He's been writing about these debates for a long time. He has an excellent long read preview in The Atlantic and at theatlantic.com. I urge you to read it. James Fallows, it's been great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, we've been asking you, if you were in charge of the presidential debates, how would you run them?
This is Joan from Illinois. Each question should be posed to each candidate exactly the same wording. Each candidate should answer each question within a reasonable set time limit, and at a certain point of overtime, the microphone should simply be turned off. Who should moderate? In my dreams, it would be Jon Stewart.
We got this from Oklahoma City. I would model the presidential debates after the 80s Nickelodeon game show Double Dare, and I'd add a twist from the variety show You Can't Do That on Television, where if a candidate lies, they get doused in green slime. This doesn't sound terribly unrealistic to me. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. A crime on its face usually looks pretty clear-cut. A drug deal gone bad, a robbery, somebody punches a cop and gets jail time for it. Then there are the cases where things aren't quite what they seem. Not confounding just to observers like you and me, but to the criminal justice system itself. Sometimes there are cases where the lurching gears and levers of justice just can't handle it. And the Takeaway is teaming up with the nonprofit news organization, The Marshall Project, for a new series called Case in Point. This week, it's the case of William Palmer, which raises a lot of questions about the meaning of criminal intent under the law. Now, it all began back in 2009. Palmer's girlfriend, Kay Anderson, saw that he was behaving erratically and strangely. She decided it was best to hide the guns in their home. When William Palmer couldn't find his guns, he called 911 to report them stolen. And according to court documents, Palmer then gave the phone to Anderson, who told the operator she feared for her safety. State troopers were dispatched to the residence right away. And when they got there, they found Palmer brandishing an assault rifle.
The problem for police and prosecutors is that Palmer's bizarre behavior didn't end when he was arrested. He went immediately to jail. There was an initial hearing. The judge who saw him hours after the incident was so alarmed by his behavior that he basically ordered a competency hearing. Palmer was defecating on tables and smearing his own feces around. He clearly was not in his right mind, so much so that he eventually ended up that very day at the hospital where he was diagnosed as having a brain aneurysm that had ruptured into a brain hemorrhage. So essentially, on the day that he has this problem with the police, he is suffering from brain damage that is so severe that he has to have emergency surgery. Prosecutors know it happens, and they still continue to press the case against him. The initial report from a state psychologist was that he still, days later, a couple of weeks later, was disoriented and didn't really understand what had happened. A second evaluation, a little bit further down the road, showed that his injury had cleared up a little bit. He was now more oriented and less competent to stand trial. So the prosecutor knows all of this, and yet the trial proceeds down the road.
Right. Well, I mean, we're used to hearing about cases where people claim to be not legally culpable because of mental illness or psychotic breaks, things like that, not guilty by reason of insanity. Those things might be familiar. But this seems, on the face of it, to be an open and shut case for the defense, right? Just go to the jury and say, here's the medical record. He was having an aneurysm, and these doctors over here will tell you that that can mess with your behavior.
So that's essentially what Palmer's lawyer wanted to argue. Hey, my guy isn't intellectually disabled in a long-term sense of the word. He doesn't have that cognitive problem and hasn't had it for years. He just had a medical condition, a physical condition that rendered his brain incapable of acting rationally, incapable of acting other than how he acted. Prosecutors disputed that. They did not want to hear that defense from Palmer. They said that he had to show mental disease or defect. That's another sort of prong in Alaska law. The reason prosecutors wanted that is because they wanted to require Palmer again to undergo more psychological evaluations, which he and his lawyers weren't willing to do. So you get this big pretrial fight going into this, what should have been a minor trial, over the nature of a medical condition and its impact and its effect on criminal intent, the idea of mens rea.
But what prevents Mr. Palmer's lawyers from going right to some neurologists to look at his CAT scans or his brain films or his medical history, whatever it is, and say, yeah, in my professional opinion, he had a big brain aneurysm, and that can make you aggressive and disoriented?
Well, what prevented the attorney from doing that in this case was the judge, who sided with prosecutors. Prosecutors now, so we know that they're going forward with a case in which they know there's been a brain hemorrhage. Now prosecutors move to basically block the defense from arguing that it was a brain hemorrhage that was responsible for the conduct. And the judge agrees and says, you know what, if you're not going to submit to these additional psychological evaluations, I'm not going to let you tell jurors that your client essentially was brain damaged on the day in question. The case proceeds to trial. Prosecutors get the state troopers to talk about how they thought that Palmer was acting drunk. And they said that they smelled alcohol on his breath. It's certainly possible that he was also drinking in addition to this brain hemorrhage. But the information comes out that Palmer is drunk. The jury is led to believe that Palmer is having a drunken episode when, in fact, the rest of us know that he wasn't.
Andrew, are there cases similar to this, or is this a very specific case of one judge in one jurisdiction depriving a jury of critical information about somebody's medical and psychological condition during a crime?
It's definitely an odd case. I've been covering these sorts of cases for a long time. I have not heard a scenario like this where even the state psychologist right, is on board in saying that there has been this brain problem and having the case go to trial and having there be a conviction. Now, there's another twist in the story that listeners might be interested in. So the same judge who basically bars the defense from putting on the defense that they wanted to put on at sentencing says, you know what, I think that Mr. Palmer was suffering from a mental disease and defect, and I'm going to reflect that in the sentence I give him. I'm going to give him a 7-year sentence, but I'm going to suspend 6 of those years so that he only has to serve a year in jail. And so that's the mercy that Palmer got from the same judge who had basically blocked jurors from hearing the truth about the case. The reason we're still talking about it 7 years later is that there was an appeal. The defense said, wait a minute, we were essentially denied our constitutional right to a fair trial by not being able to put on our defense and by being required by the judge to choose between incriminating ourselves in this psychological evaluation or giving up the truth and the best defense that we had. So the Alaska courts are still wrangling with it, even though Mr. Palmer, as he nears the age of 70, is living presumably back in his home.
As a convicted felon.
As a convicted felon. And it's going to be fascinating to see how the Alaska courts deal with it. Everybody who was sort of around at the time has moved on. This is a very interesting issue, not just in Alaska, the idea of medical conditions impacting criminal intent. And of course, that's a universal theme that we're hearing about, not just in criminal cases, but really on the political scene in Washington with this big push for what's called mens rea reform on Capitol Hill.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at The Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. It's a biweekly column that sheds light on a single case or character from the criminal justice system.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The 71st UN General Assembly starts in New York today. On the agenda, a sideline meeting between President Obama and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. More on that coming up. But also on his way to New York is North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho. And his country last week shook the world, literally and figuratively too, when it conducted its 5th nuclear test. Just yesterday, American bombers streaked over the skies in South Korea in a show of force to people on both sides of that border. So what does North Korea really want, and what, aside from war, can get them to back off? Daryl Kimball is here. He's executive director of the Arms Control Association. Daryl, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
There's a long history here, of course, of international sanctions, deals with North Korea that have been broken, some inspections. What's going on here with the incentives that international sanctions and isolation aren't deterring North Korea right now?
It's painfully obvious now that a sanctions-only approach vis-a-vis North Korea is not effective enough. North Korea is not integrated into the international economy like Iran is. The same sort of sanctions approach that worked well to change Iran's calculations are not going to work quite the same here. Plus, China is not necessarily willing to press those sanctions hard enough really to make it count. So we're in a different situation here, and what's missing from the equation is engagement with North Korea. We have not had effective negotiations with North Korea's diplomats in many years.
So you said that the situation with North Korea is different from Iran. Iran had billions and billions of dollars tied up in the world economy that it wanted access to. That was part of what brought them to the table for the nuclear deal that was struck with Iran. What does North Korea want then that this type of engagement would be effective? Would it be a deal that could look something similar to the Iran deal, even if the details are different?
Well, I think in vague terms, it might look similar in that there has to be a win-win formula for both sides. So what might the North Koreans be interested in if they sat down with regional powers? They are concerned about their security. They have long worried about U.S.-South Korean military exercises. They are also very interested in integrating into the international economy. And Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, does understand that there are severe limits to his country's economy unless they do get some foreign investment. So in the long run, he is interested in easing the isolation or ending the isolation of North Korea.
Well, as we just mentioned before, North Korea's foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, is on his way to the UN. And the North Koreans don't always go to the UN. They often skip it. Can we read anything into this, that he's on his way to the big world diplomatic meeting? Does that signal an openness to negotiate, or am I reading too much into it?
We'll have to see what he says. He could offer us an olive branch, or he could be thumping his chest. The North is quite proud of this latest nuclear test. It could be a trip to New York and the United Nations to signal defiance to the international community, or it could be sending another signal, which is that they are open to negotiations, but on slightly different terms than the United States has been offering.
It seems like a situation that's going to take a great deal of nuanced leadership and patience and not impulsivity on the part of the Americans.
I think that is a fair statement. I think it's also going to require patience and persistence. It's also going to take a lot of courage as well as nuance. I just think that it is an essential part of U.S. strategy. It's not been a key part of our toolkit over the last several years, and I think that's one reason why we've not been more effective. The other problem, however, is, you know, the North Koreans have advanced their program, and it is going to be much more difficult to convince them to ratchet back their program, to roll back their program.
The world will be watching for signals from the North Korean delegation at the UN this week. North Korea has just conducted its fifth and most troubling nuclear test. Daryl Kimball, Executive Director of the Arms Control Association, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we mentioned, there is a sideline meeting at the UN this week. President Obama and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko will meet. The agenda will likely focus on how to deal with Ukraine's ongoing low-level civil war that involves Eastern separatists and, of course, Russia. Now, Russia has continued to build up its military presence in that region since it annexed Crimea in 2014. Thousands have died since in that war. Russian President Vladimir Putin is staying away from the UN this week. He and President Obama did discuss Ukraine at the G20 earlier this month. That was a conversation that was described with that old diplomatic euphemism, constructive. William Courtney is former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and Georgia, and now he's adjunct senior fellow at the nonpartisan nonprofit RAND Corporation, and he joins me now. Ambassador William Courtney, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, Todd.
The practical agenda here between Barack Obama and Petro Poroshenko at the UN, what's on their immediate list?
There are two main issues in the relationship. The first and most important from a diplomatic perspective is trying to find a resolution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. That's a conflict in which Russia launched on its own. There was no civil war or civil unrest there before Russia sent in its own rebels, if you will, and tried to organize protests. The Russian rebels, supported by Russian forces, substantial Russian forces on both sides of the border, control parts of two oblasts or regions in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk. That conflict for Russia has gone sour. 10,000 people have died. A lot of international attention has been focused on it, and the West has levied important economic sanctions on Russia. So by comparison with Crimea, which Russia took over bloodlessly, eastern Ukraine has turned out poorly for Russia.
And President Obama faced a lot of criticism over the last year or more from both parties, many of his allies who wanted to send weapons and arm the Ukrainian government in this conflict. He has resisted doing it. In retrospect, was that the right call, or should the United States still consider sending arms to the Ukrainian government as they fight this low-level war?
In defense of the policy of the Obama administration, it has provided substantial assistance, over $600 million worth of assistance, and of that, over $250 million has been military aid. That's been primarily training and the provision of non-lethal equipment, everything from combat gear, if you will, just basic combat gear, to counter mortar radars, night vision goggles, and things like that. That's been a big help to Ukraine. In retrospect, it would have been helpful to have provided defensive weaponry, in particular anti-armor weapons. The Ukrainians asked for something called the Javelin, which is a sophisticated anti-armor weapon that's capable against the most advanced Russian tanks. That would have increased the deterrent power of Ukraine's forces and caused Russia to think twice about escalating the conflict. But if Russia were to escalate again, then there would be stronger pressures to provide that defensive lethal weaponry to Ukraine.
So you've already stipulated that so much of this depends on Russia pulling out of eastern Ukraine. Does Russia have any incentive now to do what you're describing? Is there any incentive that we can provide them to get them to pull out of eastern Ukraine?
A major incentive is that Russia is now more isolated from the West than it's ever been since it became independent a quarter century ago. A second issue is that the Western economic sanctions have had some significant impact on the economy, not as important as the oil price drop has had. That's been much greater on the economy. But in addition to the direct impact of the sanctions, the fact that Russia is engaged in this aggression in eastern Ukraine has raised overall political risks in Russia, and that's deterred foreign investors. Russia needs a lot of foreign investment and technology to modernize its economy. So there are significant incentives, but for Russia to pull out of eastern Ukraine would involve a certain loss of faith. Russia has made some concessions in the past, for example, canceling a gas pipeline to Turkey when it became clear that that was not going to be viable. But there's no sign at the moment that Russia is ready to pull out of eastern Ukraine. There's no sign whatsoever it will pull out of Crimea, and the West is not really giving Crimea priority, if you will, in diplomacy.
William Courtney, former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and Georgia, now adjunct senior fellow at the RAND Corporation. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Sprint kayaking is making its debut at the 2016 Paralympic Games in Rio this week. And that means that it's also the first time 33-year-old sprint kayaker Elena Nichols will be competing at the Paralympic level. Well, at this sport, anyway. Nichols is no rookie. She's already a six-time Paralympic medalist and the first female athlete to win gold medals in both summer and winter games. Before sprint kayaking, she competed in para-alpine skiing, and before skiing, she won a gold medal in wheelchair basketball. Now, Nichols' role as an Olympic champion is only part of her story here. She's been an athlete her entire life, despite an accident as a teenager that left her paralyzed from the waist down. In 2009, when she was already competing on the world stage, her older brother was murdered. But Nichols has committed herself to being a positive example for other people as she competes for her seventh career medal, this time in the sprint kayak finals that are coming up on Thursday.
Part of what's really motivated me up until this point, I guess, so going back to my original story, I broke my back in a snowboarding accident when I was 17 years old and became paralyzed at that point. And before that injury, I was a three-sport athlete in high school. So I played basketball, volleyball, and softball then. And after my injury, you know, becoming a person with a significant disability and having to use a wheelchair every day, I didn't know that I could be an athlete anymore. And for me, after learning about all of these opportunities, I just was chomping at the bit to try everything. And for me, one of the most motivating things is just to see what I can do. And it's also about showing other young women with disabilities what they can do and what's possible for people with disabilities.
You've talked about what it meant for you to turn to sports after your injury, after seeing other athletes perform, not wanting, frankly, to even go on living when you went from being an athlete to being somebody in a wheelchair, and about the loss of your brother when you already were an athlete and what mobility and sports have meant to you.
Yeah, I didn't want to go on living. And also life post-traumatic loss of my brother was unbearable. And it was really sports, namely wheelchair basketball after my injury and then alpine skiing after my brother died, that got me back into life and that allowed me to keep moving forward. Part of what I've been so passionate about doing since my injury is really breaking that perception down, showing people what's possible, skiing down a mountain at 70 miles per hour, doing three sports at a Paralympic level, and then, you know, more importantly, getting my master's degree at the University of Alabama. And and teaching young women that they have so much more to offer than they think they do. And just because they're disabled doesn't mean that they can't dream big.
Well, Elena, another aspect of this that you've addressed in some ways is the myth that disabled people are condemned to a sedentary life, that to be in a wheelchair, for instance, means to be sedentary.
You know, I understand that in the early 60s and 70s, you know, people with disabilities were not treated equally, and it wasn't until the Americans with Disabilities Act came along in the early 90s that we started to see some equality. But I think we're still really dealing with this idea of what a person with a disability has to offer. You know, we've set our expectations so low for people with disabilities. We don't expect them to get jobs. We don't create opportunities for them to get involved in mainstream workforce. And that really puts a damper on what people with disabilities think that they can do. And, you know, one of the most important things is raising awareness. If I can do my job physically as an alpine skier with a significant disability, I think it's possible for people to adapt a work environment for anybody with a disability. And as a person with a disability early on, I literally counted all the things that I had lost. I'd never play fast pitch softball in college. I wouldn't, you know, dance in high heels, you know, whatever it looked like. I was looking at all the negatives. And it wasn't until I started playing sports that I started thinking about, oh, okay, you know what? I know how to play basketball. I understand the game. I've got my arms, those work. I've got my heart and my passion for sport. And I can play this at a Paralympic level. And with that, I can go on to get a master's degree in kinesiology and help other athletes become the best that they can be. And, you know, that for me was a huge turning point when I started to look at all the things that I could do as opposed to what I couldn't do.
So let's get back to Rio and the games you're competing in now. There was so much scrutiny of the infrastructure built for all of the games this summer and into the fall. How has the infrastructure been from your perspective, both in terms of access, but in terms of the event sites and the venues that you're competing in?
You know what? Everything is awesome. I wasn't sure what to expect. I had gotten some report from the Olympic athletes I know. And you know, it's the mainstream media has really got away about blowing up the negative aspects of each games. And this is my fifth Paralympic Games now. And each individual games that I've been to has had something that the media has just latched onto. Here in Rio, they really harped on the water quality. They've really harped on the infrastructure, but everything is working just fine for every type of disability here in the village. My particular venue is perfectly accessible for people in wheelchairs or on crutches. I think the Brazilian people have done a great job with hosting. I know it certainly wasn't easy on their economy and, you know, their communities, but I think that they've embraced this sort of chaos. You know, any city that holds a games is, it's going to be chaotic. And I think they've done a really great job with it.
So Elena Nichols, is this it for you? This is your fifth games. Is there a sixth in store? I mean, you compete in summer and winter, so it's only 2 years right before you could be back on the slopes for the USA.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I might be racking up sports, and I more recently just learned how to surf. So it's adaptive surfing, and I love it. I love everything about adaptive surfing. I sit on what's called a wave ski, which is a 7-foot, 6-inch long board by 25 inches wide. It has a hip strap, and I use a kayak paddle to propel myself into the wave. Once I'm on the wave, I dig the paddle into the water to cut up and down the wave and perform. And I love the experience altogether, and I'm hoping to spearhead this movement and get it into the Paralympic Games in 2024, where hopefully LA will be hosting.
Well, Elena Nichols, I want to wish you all the luck this week in sprint kayak in Rio at the Paralympics, going for your 7th Paralympic medal for the USA. Good luck.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks again for covering this. It's awesome.
Elena Nichols joined me from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where she's competing in her fifth Paralympic Games, this time in the sprint kayak. Her story is also profiled in a new documentary film, Tin Soldiers, that's available now on iTunes and Amazon Video. And here's something to take with you today. The internet, TV, you know, commonality is great, but we're losing some of America's great vernacular. The podcasting network Acast is trying to save dying slang in America. They're asking podcast hosts to use it in their shows. Otherwise, gone are the days of Southerners worrying about a frog strangler, you know, a heavy downpour. Men in the Northeast wearing their wamis, otherwise known as a work jacket. So thanks to Acast for all of their efforts. And hey, to all of you in my native Eastern Pennsylvania, thanks for listening to These Johns. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.